This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Obama and the House of Torture, Part 1, John Yoo, the Justice Department, and Jose Padilla. We begin our show with an update on the case of Lynn Stewart. And again, we have on the phone with us Ralph Poynter. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning, Maya.
How are you doing, Ralph? I mean, it's extraordinary. 1 week ago, you were having major surgery, and here you are, up and ready to go.
I can thank the government for that. Because Lynn, when she called me last night, after I was refused entry into MCC to see her, her first words were, "This is not going to get me down. I hope it doesn't get you down." And my answer, of course, was, "It will not get me down. We will do something to change the situation, or if we don't, we will survive that too."
Ralph, you were refused entry to the Metropolitan Correction Center when it had already been established that you had the right to see Lynn.
Yes, it had. As a matter of fact, I received the okay from Lynn while I was in the hospital getting double knee surgery. And she had said, "You're up for Monday." And I says, "And I'm going to be able to walk in there. If there's any problem, if I can't take my canes or metal, I'm going to walk." And the week after surgery, I walked. So I have to thank the government for that. I wouldn't have been working so hard otherwise.
But then they refused entry to you.
Yes.
And without reason, without explanation.
Well, when I asked, the gentleman who handed me back my passport said, "It has nothing to do with your paperwork. I've just been told you can't come in." End of the story. Last night, Lynn called and said, "It's not going to get her down." And this morning, Sarah Kunstler, who's a part of the team that's defending Lynn, called to say yesterday she spoke to the people who were responsible and everything was okay. That was yesterday. She was surprised to hear, so she called me around 8:30 this morning to say they're working on it again. They will talk to whoever is in charge to see if I can possibly get in this week. The visits for Lynn are every other Monday or every other Friday. 1 week Monday, 1 week Friday. We've missed Monday, but maybe something can be worked out. Hopefully so.
And the pretext in the past has been that some 40 years ago, when you were organizing in Harlem, when the police began to brutalize the people there, you stood up to the cops. So they're not going to let you in see Lynn in prison 40 years later.
Let me get a little more involved in that. When Lynn was representing Nasser Ahmed, the gentleman who spent 3.5 years in prison on secret evidence, I was the investigator. And I visited him several times. We were trying to figure out who was giving these ugly rumors out. And I think in the visiting room, we had come close. The next week when I went back to talk to him, I was denied entrance. And Lynn says to the warden, "What's that about?" The warden says, "I don't know. He's just been denied entrance." And Lynn says, "I'm not going in if he doesn't go in. Call whoever it is." So she came back and said, "This is from Washington. He is not to visit because of the nature of his crimes." So as it turned out, the person who was passing the ugly rumors about one of the members of the mosque was passing out flyers and talking to people. Flyers he didn't know what was on. Talking to people he didn't know what about. And they kept this man in jail for 3.5 years on nonsense such as this. So I said to Lynn afterward, "Well, I guess they're listening in." Luckily for us, there was a courageous immigration judge who then examined the sheikh, and it became obvious that he had seen nothing. He was an agent from Egypt, passed these rumors. The government called it secret evidence, kept this man in jail, and this courageous judge let Nasser Ahmed out. In hindsight, we go over this and say, what was happening there? They said from Washington it was the nature of his previous arrest. And I'm saying, what was the nature of my previous arrest? And we can go into the whole school struggle, the miseducation of black teachers, the misappropriation of money, the lack of control of black communities over their school system, and the refusal to take abuse from police. As my son said to me this morning, he said, gee, for a 75-year-old guy, you're pretty solid. Because I'm walking around, and he says, well, you know, go back 40 years, you must have been able to give them what for. And I said, self-defense is something that we can never give up, and self-determination we can never give up. I refuse to give it up on the street, in the courts, whatever. I guess that's the nature of my crime. And it wasn't long after that that Lynn herself was arrested. She was called every name in the book. People said they wished for her death, etc. So I stayed close to Lynn for the past 7 years, and here we are.
Let's give Lynn's address. Lynn Stewart, 53504-054, MCC/New York, 150 Park Row, New York, New York, 10000. That's 0007. 10007. I was reading once again last night the appellate decision. Even the appellate judges are impressed by Lynn Stewart. Now, that doesn't stop them from concluding that they would like to put her away for many years, or maybe it's because she's so impressive in her legal career that they want to put her away. They write, "We are impressed by the factors that figured in Stewart's modest sentence," referring to the 28-month sentence, "particularly her admirable history of providing, at no little personal cost to herself, proficient legal services in difficult cases to those who could not otherwise afford them."
That sums her up perfectly.
And this is the appellate judges. And after that, they go on to say, it is because Lynn is this admirable lawyer that she should have a stiffer sentence, to say something not only to Lynn, which Judge Kirtle said that taking away Lynn's ability to practice law was an incredible punishment in itself for Lynn and to the world. And yet the judges, the appellate judges, say that isn't enough. It's because she's a lawyer that we have to point to her, and we have to show the world that she needs a much stiffer sentence.
Well, I want to say something about that, Maya and Ralph. This is at the heart of the inherent criminal nature of the state. Today, we received a book recently published by the award-winning writer and attorney Louis Begley. And the book is called Why the Dreyfus Affair Matters. And here's the description of the book from Yale University Press. At the center of the infamous Dreyfus Affair are the conviction by illegal means and the five-year-long torment of an innocent man found guilty by a military tribunal in 1894 of selling secrets to the Germans. French Army Captain Alfred Dreyfus was sentenced to perpetual imprisonment. A special law was passed so he could serve his sentence on Devil's Island, an arid rock formation off the shore of French Guiana. He was held in solitary confinement in a stone cell with no relief from tropical heat and forbidden any communication with guards or others. He suffered open sores from iron buckles with which he was shackled to his bed, malarial fever, infected insect bites, and dysentery. There was no precedent in French law for Dreyfus's brutal treatment. Now, the essence of what Begley is stating is that this was an innocent man, and all those associated with that innocent man, notably in his defense, were similarly targeted by the French state. And it should be mentioned when Émile Zola, who is famous for having made the Dreyfus Affair cause célèbre with his manifesto and book called J'accuse, I Accuse, when he died and his remains were taken to the Pantheon, at the ceremony was Dreyfus, and there he was shot and wounded by a military officer, almost fatally wounded, and the military officer was acquitted by the French courts because it was called a crime of passion. What is the crime of Lynn Stewart? Dreyfus was an innocent man, and Begley says, someday in the near future, the crimes of the Bush administration, like the crimes against Dreyfus, will disappear under the scar tissue of silence and indifference. The analogy is made. Let me just say this. The Rital Render office, which rented the van to the person who was supposedly involved in the plot to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993, were Federal Bureau of Investigation operatives. The telephone number in the apartment rented for the organization of this event was by the Mossad operative Guzi Hadass. During her occupancy, the chemicals and bombs were stored there, supplied by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The name on the rental agreement? Guzi Hadass, the author of the plans to blow up the Lincoln Tunnel and the Holland Tunnel and the Statue of Liberty, to assassinate Senator Alphonse D'Amato and United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, the author of those plans, Imad Ali Salem and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Who was representing the falsely accused sheikh who was sentenced to 100 years in prison, who was kept in total isolation, sensory deprivation? It was Lynn Stewart. What is the timing of this appellate decision to send her to prison and to demand an increase in her sentence? The announcement of a phony show trial in New York of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. By the way, one of the crimes that they're charging him with and that he's supposed to have confessed to? Why, plotting to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993.
And let me also add that I have often said to Lynn Stewart, you are our Emil Zola. You have taken this difficult case, you've taken it to heart, and I believe you're going to win it one day because there is much that has yet to be brought out about these charges. But go ahead, Ralph.
Thank you, Ralph. And what is at the heart of the matter, as Begley makes clear about the French state, and as he specifically states regarding what he calls the crimes of the Bush administration, of course, this book was written before there was an Obama administration, the crimes of the Bush and Obama administration, the crimes of the capitalist state. What is at stake here is the exposure of the fake war on terror, and the targeting of innocent people, and the terrorizing of the American public by the state itself. That's what Lynn Stewart represents, the assault on our liberty, the assault on our future, and the need to resist a criminal state and those in charge of it.
Lynn Stewart, 53504-054, MCC, New York, 150 Park Row, New York, New York, 10007. Three zeros.
And Ralph, we're trying and we're seeking to mobilize people across the United States and abroad to write to Judge Kotel, to write to Judge Kotel and demand that there should be no increase in sentence. In fact, from my perspective, to demand that Lynn Stewart should be freed, an innocent woman framed and charged no less than the sheikh she defended. But write to the judge, everybody who's within our hearing, and encourage all those to do the same.
And when you write to Lynn Stewart, add your return address, because she loves letters. She writes an answer to your letters, and she says it is so uplifting for her to get these letters and to be able to talk to people directly through them. That keeps her going. That keeps us all going. There will be many other things that we will be asking you to do before Lynn is resentenced. But stay tuned to Ralph and Maya and Taking Aim, because they have been champions of Lynn for a long, long time, because they see clearly what is happening to the judicial system. They see clearly what is happening with the so-called black flag operations of America that they have been doing across the world. Thank you so much, Ralph and Maya. We will be in touch as to what is happening.
Thank you, Ralph. We'll be with you again next week.
I will look forward to speaking to you again next week, and maybe by next week I will be able to give you a direct message. The phone is one thing, but as Lynn says, you know, give Maya a hug for her. Well, I can't do that because you're in California, but I can give Lynn a hug for Maya, maybe.
For both of us, Ralph.
Okay, Ralph.
Take care.
Thanks, Ralph. See you next week.
Thank you very much.
Today, our show, Obama and the House of Torture, Part 1, John Yoo, the Justice Department, and Jose Padilla. Let's look at what's been happening with the Obama administration. As Ralph mentioned before, the important book by Louis Begley, Why the Dreyfus Affair Matters. Begley wrote prior to the Obama administration and read his proofs just after the inauguration. He had some expectations, false expectations, of President Barack Obama. And he points in his prologue to Obama's statement at the inauguration, quote, "As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man. A charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake." Those are the words of Barack Obama at his inauguration. As Begley says, thus in two lofty sentences, the president rejected the Bush-Cheney heritage of trampling on America's international obligations under both the Geneva Convention and the UN Convention Against Torture, while at the same time evading or violating the laws and constitution of the United States. An end had come to the era of dragnet detentions and mistreatment or worse of alleged enemy combatants and secret CIA prisons. President Obama had taken the first step toward redeeming his campaign pledge to close Guantanamo and bring the United States back under the rule of law. Well, fine words from Louis Begley, but as we will show today on Taking Aim, the change promised by the Obama administration is a reaffirmation of the destruction of the rights so hallowed here in the United States.
Well, Maya, these are rights largely in the absence of their keeping, their formal rights usually not in play. Over the long course of American history, large and massive sections of our population have been outside the reach of those rights. Not only African Americans and Native Americans, but the hungry and the exploited and the oppressed consistently and throughout our history. And case after case, whether it's that of Sacco and Vanzetti or Joe Hill or Tom Mooney or countless examples can be cited. They are well known to our listeners. Let us be very clear about the formal character of these rights. They are largely present for those who are advantaged and largely absent for those who are exploited. And fundamentally, I want to make this point before we examine what the actual record and behavior of the Obama administration itself has been with respect to the maintenance of the specter of a military and martial law state in the United States. Every one of these draconian measures, every violation of the formal protections of the Bill of Rights, took place with the sanction of the majority and the leadership of the Democratic Party. The votes in the Senate, the votes in the House for the Patriot Act, for all of the financial appropriations for the military wars, for the secret wars, for the detention centers, for the rendition of and torture of target people, sanctioned and supported by the leadership of the Democratic Party and by the votes of Barack Obama himself long before he assumed the office of the presidency. Let's be clear about this, brothers and sisters. Louis Begley is an important figure. His book has great merit. His allusions to Barack Obama are without basis or without justification.
Ralph, on December 3rd, the Department of Justice attorneys, that is the Obama Department of Justice, the attorneys there filed an amicus curiae, that is a Friends of the Court brief on behalf of John Yoo. John Yoo had been the Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel during the Bush administration, and he is the notorious draftsman of the Bush torture memos and also the memos stating that the president had supreme powers in his position as the commander-in-chief. These torture memos are being considered before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which reviews the federal court decisions in the Western United States. The brief urges a reversal of District Judge Jeffrey S. White's refusal to dismiss the case that was brought against you by Jose Padilla. You, at the moment, is a professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law, that's Balt Hall. Padilla is a U.S. citizen. He had been held incommunicado and tortured for over 2 years after he was seized at Chicago O'Hare Airport, and President Bush declared him an enemy combatant. He was held in the Brig in South Carolina and tortured. And this is something we've discussed on Taking Aim and past shows, and we're once again going to revisit this with the current case. But this wasn't the only case where the Obama administrations have supported the House of Torture. The Obama administration's lawyers supported the dismissal of suits that were brought by the CIA victims of extraordinary renditions. They have supported the government's eavesdropping, that is, illegal wiretapping, and they have supported the former Bush and now current Obama administration practice of transporting detainees from the Middle East to the U.S. military base in Afghanistan, Bagram, which has been expanded and is the House of Torture. Ralph.
Well, Maya, before we address the specifics of the Justice Department's defense of John Yoo and the Justice Department's defense of the positions adopted by the torture memorandum author John Yoo and that of the administration of George Bush, as the Wall Street Journal cited famously in an article which we will cite in a short time, Obama channels Cheney. But the Obama administration, as the World Socialist website noted on the 10th of February 2009, has defended torturers consistently. As the World Socialist website wrote at that time, all of the Obama administration's rhetoric about change you can believe in and government transparency and democratic ideals went up in smoke in a San Francisco federal courtroom. The federal attorney representing President Barack Obama and his attorney general Eric Holder rose to announce that the new administration will stand firm in defending the positions adopted by George Bush and his Justice Department involving the most heinous crimes of the previous administration. Obama is invoking the state secrets privilege to quash cases brought on behalf of those abducted by the Central Intelligence Agency, held in secrecy, without charge, transported to third countries, and tortured. The practice known as extraordinary rendition has come to symbolize for people the world over everything that was lawless, sadistic, and reactionary about the Bush administration. Contained within this lawless act of the U.S. government were all the most nightmarish features of a police state dictatorship, writes the World Socialist website. People were torn from their homes and families by jackbooted men dressed in black, wearing masks. They became disappeared persons, and their very existence in U.S. custody was denied by Washington. Denied any protection afforded to either criminal suspects or prisoners of war, they were held for years without charge. Thousands have disappeared, subjected to the most barbaric forms of torture. The case in San Francisco involves five specific victims of this state crime brought against not the CIA and the government, but one of their corporate accomplices, Jepson Data Plan, a Boeing subsidiary organized and profiting from the secret CIA rendition flights in which those abducted were flown in private aircraft, hooded, shackled, and drugged CIA-run private aircraft to, quote, black sites, unquote, torture chambers around the world. Though not a defendant in this case, the Justice Department intervened, invoking the state secrets privilege and claiming that going forward in any way with proceedings would present a threat to national security. A lower court concurred, and the hearing was held before the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, where attorneys for the five abducted men sought the lawsuit's reinstatement. Obama's representative intervened once again and demanded that the case be thrown out. Ben Wisner, the American Civil Liberties Union attorney, condemned this action. "We are shocked and profoundly disappointed that the Obama Justice Department continues the Bush administration's practice of suppressing and dodging judicial scrutiny of extraordinary rendition and systematic torture. This was supposed to be the opportunity for this administration to act on condemnation of torture and rendition. Instead, it has chosen to stay the course, unquote, chosen to support it, chosen to continue it, chosen to oppose any expose or any defense of the victims. And the claim that allowing the case to go forward would endanger national security was advanced by Barack Obama and his Justice Department. Ludicrous on its face, states Ben Wisner. The practice of extraordinary rendition has not only been exposed by human rights organizations and the media, but has been openly defended by all U.S. government officials. The government's aim is to suppress any legal challenge and to protect those responsible for war crimes and to prevent new evidence of the continuing official criminality from surfacing. This is but the tip of the iceberg, brothers and sisters.
Ralph, an article appeared in Harper's December 16, 2009, by Scott Horton. The state secret charade enters a new round, and it has an interesting historical perspective on just what you're talking about. Scott Horton refers, with the state secrets doctrine, to arcana imperii, that is, mysteries of the state, and this served to keep a regime in power. In the 12th century and before, an emperor could stop any court proceeding in its track by saying that state secrets were involved. Doesn't this sound familiar? And in the Lynn Stewart case, the appellate judges confirm that state secrets are just that. The government can declare any information to be a state secret and keep it from the defense. Arcana imperii. He also notes disappearances have been viewed throughout international law as a compelling law, a higher law. Ralph and I don't hold to a tenet that the international law is anything other than the political justification
of the bourgeois state.
Of the bourgeois state.
And all of the crimes thereof.
However, within the context of the bourgeois state, jus cogens, that is, compelling law, higher law, refers explicitly to disappearances. And recently, the international courts overturned in Argentina the immunity that had been given to government officials who were involved in the disappearances of the dirty war in Argentina. Yet, here we have in the United States disappearances being justified by the highest levels of government. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Obama and the House of Torture, Part 1, John Yoo, the Justice Department, and Jose Padilla. Ralph?
Well, Maya, we're going to particularize the circumstance and the meaning of the case of Jose Padilla. But before we do that, I want to specify what the World Socialist website correctly calls the hideous nature of these crimes, spelled out in the complaint filed by the lawyers for the five men, which the Obama Justice Department refuses to allow to proceed. One of them was Binyan Mohammed, an Ethiopian national and a British resident who was abducted and flown by the CIA to Morocco. He was beaten, suffering broken bones, loss of consciousness. His clothes were cut off with a scalpel. The same scalpel was made to make incisions in his body, including his penis. A hot, stinging liquid was poured into open wounds on his penis. He was frequently threatened with rape, electrocution, and death. He was in a moldy room with open sewage. His food was drugged. When he refused to eat, he was forcibly hooked up to two different IVs, alternately pumping different substances into his body, the consequence of which forced him to undergo painful withdrawal symptoms from the narcotics and the drugs imposed upon him. This is but the little continuation of the policies of torture that have been sustained by both administrations, the Bush and the Obama administration. And indeed, on 11th of April, 2009, Leo Panetta, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, issued an internal memo declaring that the Obama administration was opposed to any investigation of intelligence personnel who carry out torture under the Bush administration or under their own. The statement announced a blanket amnesty for any who commit violations of international human rights law. And it came on the heels of a leaked International Committee of the Red Cross report that detailed the torture of the CIA's, quote, horrifying, quote, enhanced interrogation methods. The media have ignored the International Committee of the Red Cross report. We could go into particulars of that, but I want us to proceed now with the matter of Padilla versus you. Maya?
Yes. Last June 12th, Judge Jeffrey White, a 2002 George W. Bush appointee, said that government lawyers are, quote, responsible for the foreseeable consequences of their conduct. And he's referring to John Yoo. Padilla is well within his rights, Judge White said, to sue the, quote, alleged architect of the government policy. When John Yoo was an assistant attorney general, Attorney General John Ashcroft relied upon the legal opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel. John Yoo himself explains in his own book, War by Other Means, that he was personally responsible for preparing the OLC opinion and personally recommended that Jose Padilla be militarily detained as, quote, an enemy combatant without access to counsel, courts, or family, and without due process of law. Judge White reviewed the principal documents in Padilla versus Yoo that had been prepared to give the Bush administration the pseudo-legal justification for Padilla's treatment. This included an October 23, 2001 memorandum, quote, the Fourth Amendment, that is the provision of the Bill of Rights that prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. The Fourth Amendment does not apply to domestic military operations designed to deter and prevent further terrorist attacks, end quote. And that just as, quote, wartime destruction of property does not involve a taking under the Fifth Amendment, it seems safe to conclude that the court would not apply the Fourth Amendment to domestic military operations, end quote. Judge White also cited a January 9, 2002 memorandum outlining Yoo's analysis that the treatment of al-Qaeda and Taliban members is, quote, not governed by the bulk of the Geneva Conventions, specifically those provisions concerning POWs, and the August 1, 2002, the infamous torture memo, where John Yoo wrote, quote, physical pain amounting to torture must be equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injury, such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death, end quote. And you wrote further, quote, for purely mental pain or suffering to amount to torture, it must result in significant psychological harm of significant duration, e.g., lasting for months or even years. Judge White also cited a March 14, 2003 memorandum that approved the use of mind-altering drugs during interrogations. This document states that you, quote, had received assurances from the Criminal Division of the Justice Department that prosecutions would not be brought against interrogators, reinforcing the point that even federal officials who had committed war crimes or torture under federal criminal statutes would escape responsibility for their crimes, end quote. And as Ralph mentioned, Leon Panetta has come forward and stated that this will be true for CIA agents as well. The court notes the irony, Judge wrote, of Yoo's position. Essentially, the allegations of the complaint are that Yoo drafted legal cover to shield review of the conduct of federal officials who allegedly deprived Padilla of his constitutional rights. Now Yoo argues that the very drafting itself should be shielded from judicial review. Padilla's allegations here are that the creation of such legal cover was itself an unconstitutional exercise of power. end quote. We should look at the treatment of Jose Padilla once again. We cannot forget what went on under the cover of this fake war on terror. Ralph?
In Padilla versus You, the defenders of Jose Padilla have provided a brief. It has been replicated in many publications, the terms of the torture to which he was subjected, and we will be citing it. But it is worthwhile to go over aspects of the actual document that was filed.
This is the document filed by Natalie Bridgman of San Francisco and Jonathan Freeman and Hope Metcalf of the National Litigation Project Lowenstein International Human Rights Clinic at Yale University. It's Jose Padilla and Estelle LeBron, who was Padilla's mother, versus John Yu. It cites the various memoranda, and then it states, from June 9, 2002 until March 4, 2004, Mr. Padilla was deliberately denied all contact with persons outside the military brig, including his family and lawyers. During this period, Mr. Padilla's only human contact was with interrogators during interrogation sessions or with guards when they delivered his meals through a slot in his cell door or escorted him to the shower or the concrete cage in which he was intermittently permitted to exercise. Let's look at some of this. In the nearly two-year period, Mr. Padilla was permitted to receive only two telephone calls from his mother, and he was never permitted to initiate calls to his mother or any members of his family. His cell measured 9 feet by 7 feet, contained only a bed, a sink, a toilet, and a small window. And this window was blacked out in order to deprive Mr. Padilla of any sunlight or view of the outdoors or even of the inside of the brig, thereby deepening his sensory deprivation and disorientation. For the bulk of his captivity, he was denied either a clock or a watch and deprived of any natural light. He could not tell day from night. He did not know the day of the week or the season or the direction of Mecca. And we should also note that for most of his incarceration in the South Carolina naval brig, he didn't even have the thinnest foam mattress on his steel cot. Ralph?
His cell was electronically monitored 24 hours a day, so there was no need for a guard to patrol his unit. He was kept in total isolation. He was in contact with no other person. In addition to prolonged confinement, he was subjected to sensory deprivation. He had no view of the outside world. The door to his cell had no window. It had a window covered by a magnetic sticker, depriving him of even a view into the hallway or adjacent common areas of his cell. He was subjected to profound and continued isolation from all sensory data. In addition to the extreme isolation, he was deprived of sleep. The sleep deprivation was achieved in a variety of ways. A number of ruses were employed to keep him from getting sleep, including continuing loud noises throughout the night. To complete his sense of isolation, he was kept from any light or any sensory data of any kind whatsoever. He couldn't distinguish night from day, and his captors turned on extremely bright lights in his cell randomly and then imposed complete darkness for extended periods of time. He was shackled and manacled with a belly chain. Noxious fumes were introduced into his cell, causing his eyes and nose to run. The temperature of his cell was manipulated, making his cell extremely cold for long periods of time and then extremely hot. He was denied the smallest and most personal shreds of human dignity, deprived of showering, having to endure, however, forced physical handling at the whim of his captors. He was lied to as to where he was. He was threatened with being cut and having alcohol poured on his wounds. He was threatened with being buried alive, with imminent execution. He had to endure continuing multiple interrogators who would scream, shake, and assault Mr. Padilla. He was given drugs forms of lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD, and phencyclidine, PCP, and other drugs unspecified. The use of these mind-altering drugs were clearly defined as torture, of course, under international U.S. law. In addition to which, he was constantly told that his attorneys were government agents and were only intending to solicit information to enable them to subject him to even more intense torture. He no longer could distinguish to whom he was speaking. He was so narcotized by his treatment that he was almost comatose. 20 months in solitary confinement, subjected to these conditions, 3 years and 8 months of continuous torture, sensory deprivation, drug-imposed, a loss of contact with reality, his consciousness, his sense of identity were systematically destroyed.
The Brig technical director, Sandy Seymour, indicated to Mr. Padilla's habeas corpus counsel, now these were the first lawyers for Jose Padilla, and they were denied access to him. They did not see him, and yet they persisted in bringing his habeas corpus case to court. The Brig technical director, Sandy Seymour, said to these attorneys that based on his long experience in corrections, he was concerned about the long-term effect on Mr. Padilla of the extreme and prolonged isolation and sensory deprivation to which Mr. Padilla was being subjected. His concerns about the potential for harm from isolation and sensory deprivation are supported by the substantial body of clinical literature and expert opinion, which holds that severe restriction of environmental and social stimulation has a profoundly deleterious effect on mental functioning, and even a few days of solitary confinement predictably cause brain patterns to become measurably abnormal. Let's look at something that was published in the New York Times by Susan Sontag, December 4th, 2006. Startling in its detail. Video is a window into a terrorist suspect's isolation. And the video to which she refers is the video of Jose Padilla being brought to the dentist. One rare visit, medical visit, that he was allowed to have. One spring day during his 3.5 years as an enemy combatant, Jose Padilla experienced a break from the monotony of his solitary confinement in a bare cell in the brig at the Naval Weapons Station in Charleston, South Carolina. Quote, "Today is May 21st, a naval official declared to a camera videotaping the event. "Right now, we're ready to do a root canal treatment on Jose Padilla, our enemy combatant." Several guards in camouflage and riot gear approached cell number 103. They unlocked a rectangular panel at the bottom of the door, and Mr. Padilla's bare feet slid through, eerily disembodied. As one guard held down a foot with his black boot, the other shackled Mr. Padilla's legs. Next, his hands emerged through another hole to be manacled. Wordlessly, the guards pushing into the cell chained Mr. Padilla's cuffed hands to a metal belt. Briefly, his expressionless eyes met the camera before he lowered his head submissively in expectation of what came next. Noise-blocking headphones over his ears and blacked-out goggles over his eyes. Then the guards, whose faces were hidden behind plastic visors, marched their masked, clanking prisoner down the hall to his root canal. The videotape of that trip to the dentist, which was recently released to Mr. Padilla's lawyers and viewed by the New York Times, offers the first concrete glimpse into the secretive military incarceration of an American citizen whose detention without charges became a test case of President Bush's powers in the fight against terror, writes Sontag. Ralph?
The imprisonment of Jose Padilla was the culmination of years-long campaigns by the Bush administration to use his persecution as a test case for dismantling constitutional and democratic rights under the aegis of the so-called War on Terror. Jose Padilla was arrested without charges by federal agents on May 8, 2002, at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. 1 month later, then-Attorney General John Ashcroft declared in a nationally televised press conference, "We have captured a known terrorist who is preparing to build and explode a radiological dispersion device or dirty bomb in the United States," unquote. And by the way, it is the same John Ashcroft who used the occasion of the David Letterman show to announce that Lynn Stewart was going to be charged with terrorism because she was defending the falsely accused Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. Based upon this charge, Jose Padilla was declared an enemy combatant, a category that, according to the Bush administration, denied him or any other person protection under either the United States Constitution or the Geneva Convention. He was transferred to military custody. He was held without charges, trial, or the right to attorney for 3 years and 8 months. In June 2004, the Justice Department claimed Padilla had made a full confession. However, officials said that the information would not be accepted in an American courtroom because of the third-degree methods employed in the interrogation. Following a number of court rulings rejecting the administration's insistence that Padilla could be held without being charged and without access to counsel, the government chose to transfer Padilla to a civilian jail in 2005, November, to avoid the Supreme Court hearing a challenge on his detention and the exposure of the circumstances, the torture to which he was subjected. New charges were then produced that had no connection whatsoever to the original claims of a dirty bomb, or subsequent claims that Padilla was plotting to blow up apartment buildings and hotels in American cities. All of that disappeared. Instead, Padilla is now charged with being the star recruit of a North American terrorist cell. He and two other defendants, Hassoun and Jayousi, the Justice Department claimed, were conspiring to commit murder overseas and provide material support for terrorism. Not an iota of evidence was present for this. During the trial, prosecutors were unable to present any evidence of Padilla's involvement or knowledge of any plan to murder, kidnap, or maim anybody. Instead, the prosecutors told the jury that Padilla had attended a training camp in Afghanistan in 1998, therefore demonstrating an intention to engage in jihad. The evidence produced by the government was non-existent. Out of over 300,000 intercepted phone conversations, only 7 involved Padilla, and none involved any code words that the prosecution claimed referred to plans to carry out terrorist attacks. The telephone calls in question discussed Padilla's desire to learn Arabic, his conversion to Islam, and nothing else. The statements allegedly made by an Al-Qaeda official named as Abu Zubaydah, who the administration claimed implicated Padilla as a member of the organization, were without any basis in evidence and were destroyed. As part of the effort to eliminate the evidence of the CIA torture of suspected terrorists, particularly because what was destroyed was the allegation made by a CIA operative without foundation. The statements made were, in fact, without any basis, in fact, and without any evidentiary production on the part of the prosecution. Prosecutors argued during the sentencing phase that a life sentence was merited because the judge should interpret murder conspiracy statutes to include, quote, dangerous intentions. They even attempted to produce an so-called Al-Qaeda training camp graduation list, which they alleged included an Arabic name, which they said was the Arabic name of Jose Padilla, without any evidence for this whatsoever. This last-minute evidence was rejected by the judge. The prosecutors insisted that the 3 years and 8 months Padilla spent in a military brig and during the 2 additional years he was held in Miami in solitary confinement had nothing to do with the criminal charges on which he was convicted and could not be taken into account in determining the sentence, nor made known to the jury. In his own sentencing brief, federal public defender Michael Caruso wrote, "Mr. Padilla's assertion that he was tortured is by any definition unassailable. There is no dispute the government intentionally inflicted unimaginable psychological pain and suffering upon Mr. Padilla. In her ruling, U.S. District Court Judge Marsha Cook said she took into consideration, quote, the harsh conditions of Padilla's confinement in a Navy brig before he was charged, including the noise, the no mattress, the no contact with a family or a lawyer. Lawyers for Padilla filed civil lawsuits in South Carolina and California against Bush administration appointees and military personnel. These were, in fact, the very lawsuits that the Justice Department of Barack Obama opposed, detailing how Padilla was kept in strict isolation, subjected to sensory deprivation, deprived of sunlight for months at a time, shackled in stress positions, threatened with imminent execution, with burial alive, put in frigid temperatures, administered drugs, and subjected to physical and psychological assault.
Ralph, Peter Wariski's article in the Washington Post, August 17, 2007, notes that it was a patriotic jury that appeared in court. One row of the jurors dressed in red, one in white, and one in blue. This red, white, and blue jury was primed to be psychologically and emotionally manipulated by the prosecutors, who were desperate for a conviction when there was little supporting evidence.
Well, I think it's important to note, Maya, that the particulars of the torture to which Jose Padilla was subjected and the fact that he received what the Wall Street Journal called a break, because he was sentenced only to 17 years imprisonment for nothing, is amplified by the following article on December 17th. Obama seeks Guantanamo-style prison on U.S. soil. With its decision to purchase a state prison in rural Illinois, the Obama administration is preparing to create the essential features of the infamous military prison in Guantanamo, indefinite detention without charges and trials by military commissions on U.S. soil. The Obama pledge to close down the prison at the United States military base in Cuba has been thus revealed as an empty gesture. The text of the letter sent to Illinois Governor Pat Quinn, who last month first proposed the use of the Thompson Correctional Center, a maximum security prison located 150 miles west of Chicago, and has the capacity to house 1,600 prisoners, and indeed, it is to be even more severe than the maximum security prison itself. An indication of the importance to the Obama administration to this proposal is that the letter to Quinn was signed by Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Attorney General Eric Holder, National Intelligence Director Dennis Blair, and Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. This is an indication of what is intended, not only for those falsely charged under the fake category of terror, but under conditions of the growing economic crisis and intensifying social struggle. This is a threat by the financial elite, by the administration of Barack Obama, by the ruling class, to every citizen of the United States.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Obama and the House of Torture, Part 1, John Yoo, the Justice Department, and Jose Padilla, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We'll be with you next week.